Welcome to Federal Insights, connecting U.S. Postal Service and its future needs, sponsored by Sprint. Now here's your host, Tom Temin.
Postal Service executives would like to have their own health plan for employees and retirees. That means about 2 million people would leave the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program. Federal News Radio senior correspondent Mike Causey discussed the implications of this move with Jim Sauber, chief of staff of the National Association of Letter Carriers, and Jessica Clement, legislative director of the National Active and Retired Federal Employees Association.
On the 18th of September, I did a column and then a radio show with Walton Francis. He's probably the world's leading authority on the federal employee health benefits program. Longtime federal worker, federal executive with Health and Human Services. He is the editor of Checkbook's Guide to Health Plans for Federal Workers, and he's sort of the leading authority. He did a paper for the Heritage Foundation. Heritage is a conservative think tank, and he did a paper for them. Which said that there are many problems with the possibility of the Postal Service setting up this reform, setting up their own health plan. Jim, would you start out and explain what the plan is, and Jessica, then give your...
Sure. The plan is not to pull out of FEBA, but to sort of segment FEBA. This would be essentially a postal FEBA. And the idea is to set a certain set of rules for postal employees, and plans that they currently have offered to them will by and large will continue to be offered, except that they'll now price those plans with separate risk pools for federal and postal employees. The main driving reason behind this is, as I think Walt Francis, really did a good job explaining when he was on your show, is that the Postal Service has this unique burden placed on it back in 2006 to pre-fund decades of future retiree health benefits over a 10-year period, and then following that for an additional 40 years, pre-funded as if it were a pension, a retirement pension. And this is not something that's required of private companies or other agencies. It's entirely unique to the Postal Service, and it basically accounts for about 90% of the Postal Service's reported losses since 2007. So it's a burden the Postal Service really can't afford, and we've search for different ways. I mean, when it was first put in, we sought a repeal of this pre-funding mandate. It doesn't make a lot of sense. That didn't quite work. We had a second proposal that actually got a majority support in the House at one time that would have required a proper valuation of the postal pension accounts within CSRS, and if it was done properly, there'd be a significant surplus in the pension plan, and that the idea was to use that surplus to cover retiree health. We just could never get a vote, even though we had 240 co-sponsors. And so really this idea of reforming FEBA and setting different rules, which the primary one being that postal employees and postal annuitants would be required to, in most cases, to enroll in Medicare at age 65. And this would sort of mimic private sector practice, standard practice in the private sector. Company health plans make a condition of continued coverage enrollment in Medicare, which is the primary payer for senior citizens. So that has the effect of reducing the future cost of retiree health benefits for FEBA and really eliminating the cost of pre-funding.
Do you know why they being, I guess, the Congress, made the pre-fund in the first place when nobody else does it, including nobody in the government? Do you know what the reasoning was?
Yeah, initially there was a proposal to do it government-wide. It was done by David Walker when he was GAO. He's concerned about long-term liabilities. That proposal was rejected by Congress, and then it was brought up in the context of a postal reform bill that was under consideration back in 2005 and 2006. And frankly, it was done for scoring purposes. It was a way to get a stream of money from the off-budget Postal Service to the on-budget OPM accounts. And it allowed them to move a bill that was basically a neutral in terms of scoring.
You know, you see that so often here in Washington. They get into these numbers and scoring and the 10-year outlook, and then they'll do a certain thing and say problem solved, and really it's not. It's just kicked down the road. Jessica, what do you think about all this?
Well, I mean, everything that Jim had just said was incredibly accurate. I would reiterate that the driving force behind this reform proposal. What Jim was talking about with both bills pending in the House and Senate, as well as bills that came before it, is this pre-funding requirement. The Postal Service has a massive liability on its books that no one else is forced to do, not only in the government, but also in the private sector. And since they haven't been paying this pre-funding requirement for the last 5 to 6 years, that's really the driving force behind reform. The commonly held belief on the Hill from some Republicans is that if they don't do this, the taxpayers will have to bail out the Postal Service. I think that notion is worthy of debate and rebuttal in and of itself. But it's this mandate to enroll in Medicare Parts A, B, and D that would allow that liability to be so reduced that it almost doesn't exist anymore. Because when you have both, as many of your listeners know, Medicare pays first, your FEHBP plan pays second. Most people have both. I think it's upwards of 80% of the FEHBP population that's over the age of 65 has both. I think we could sit here and debate the merits of having both for an entire show. It is the question that NARF gets most often. Should I take Medicare Part B? For most people, the answer is yes. What NARF objects to in the context of these bills is the mandate to take Part B for current retirees and their spouses. And you're changing the rules of the game. You're adding an additional health care benefit that these people did not plan for when they retired, that they willfully said they did not know. And it's that change for retirees and the dangerous precedents it sets that we object to as an association, not the merits of having both, because I think there certainly are, but changing the rules of the game on retirees after they've retired.
And so this would force them to go into it.
It would, as it stands. It waives any late enrollment penalties. I think that's worth
that's
noting.
Awfully decent of them.
If you're going to force them to do this, you should waive those late enrollment fees. We believe as an association, if you gave people the option to do this, you waive the late enrollment fees, most would opt in. I think you make a decision based on your health at the age of 65. That is not necessarily the decision you should have made when you hit 75. The statistics show that your health continues to decline as you get older. So it waives the late enrollment fee, but it does force current retirees. I think Walt used the 94,000 figure. I think it's closer to 76 or 84,000. That would be forced and their dependents if they are over the age of 65 to enroll in Medicare Part B.
Okay. So this is, this is pretty heavy stuff that we're looking at here. I think one of the points that Walt Francis made on the show was that the postal population is older than the general civil service population, including retirees, I assume. Mm-hmm. Is that true, and would that make a difference in the premiums?
Yeah, I think it is true. OPM testified about this, although the difference is very small. Mm-hmm. It's about a 1% difference in terms of cost to cover postal employees versus federal employees. And I think, frankly, those numbers are a little out of date now. The Postal Service has actually had quite a lot of turnover in recent years, and we've actually been growing with the e-commerce boom. And there's been a lot of, we have 40,000 young people have been converted to career jobs just in the last 2 years. So I think over time, that difference will probably narrow. In any case, the point that Mr. Francis missed in his analysis was, although the postal population might be slightly more expensive to insure, the impact of fully integrating with Medicare being the primary payer, means that premiums for FEBA plans covering postal employees would actually go down on a net basis, because the savings from Medicare integration and from getting access to low-cost drugs through the Medicare Modernization Act and other reforms that are included in this would drive premiums down. So all the people, all the actives, all the retirees, including those in and outside of Medicare, their premiums would go down under this proposal. And this helps reduce the cost of pre-funding as well.
Jim Sauber is Chief of Staff for the National Association of Letter Carriers, and Jessica Clement is Legislative Director of the National Active and Retired Federal Employees Association. They're speaking with Federal News Radio's Mike Causey. More from this interview coming up after this short break. I'm Tom Temin.
Employees, retirees, and contractors for the United States Postal Service. After handling all that mail and heavy parcels, Sprint would like to make one bill a little lighter. The United Freedom Plan from Sprint costs even less because of where you work. Get two lines for $90 per month and up to 10 additional lines for only $25 per line. No more worrying about running out of data or surprise overage charges. Get unlimited data, talk, and text all while on the Sprint network. Restrictions apply. Learn more at a local Sprint store or visit sprint.com/USPS discount.
You're listening to Federal Insights, connecting U.S. Postal Service and its future needs. Federal News Radio senior correspondent Mike Causey spoke with Jessica Clement, legislative director of the National Active and Retired Federal Employees Association, and Jim Sauber, chief of staff for the National Association of Letter Carriers.
The subject is the proposal by the Postal Service and others to reform the system by having their own postal insurance plan within the federal employee health benefits program. So you, Jim, I think you said it would be segmented, but it would still be in it. And you wanted to say something about the NALC's position.
Yes. In general, we support this idea conceptually. It's going to be a way to solve a thorny problem, the pre-funding problem. And in general, we think it's in our members' best interest for when they retire to enroll in Medicare Part B. The only thing I just wanted to note was that we have not endorsed or supported the bill as currently drafted because there are some things that we would like to change in it. And on the issue of Medicare, we want to maximize participation in Medicare, and we want to provide for a hardship exemption for those who, when they faced with this, especially the existing seniors, people already 65 or older who have not enrolled in Medicare Part B, we want to give them a chance to take a look at the specifics of their situation, and in cases where there's tremendous hardship, or even a hardship at all, we'd like to waive that requirement for them, just to kind of look after. I agree with Jesse. I think by and large most people are going to do it. We hear from a lot more seniors who really regretted not enrolling in Medicare Part B at age 65, and now 10 years later the cost is just prohibitive because it's a 10% a year penalty. And by and large, we think most people are going to see this as really good for them. But we do want to protect people in special circumstances.
Right. So if they waive that penalty, then it would be a very good thing for virtually all retirees.
So the proposal that NARF came up with that was offered as an amendment very quickly during the markup of this bill in committee was automatically enroll them. We're talking about people who... the best way I can describe it is decisional inertia. Mm-hmm. This is a risk-averse population. This is a group of people who do not change their plans during open season when they probably should, who are probably overpaying for health insurance if they have Medicare and FEHBP. So given the nature of the federal community, given the decisions they've made up until this point, we feel that if you automatically enroll them in Medicare, as the House bill does, which is a vast improvement over the Senate bill, and allow them a very short window to opt out, hardship or otherwise, maybe they have an HMO that covers all their costs, Medicare would just be an additional cost with very little benefit, give them this short time period to opt out, we believe very few would do so. Because we've also heard from the people that Jim described, they made the wrong decision at 65. On the flip side, we've also heard from the postal retirees who made the decision not to take Medicare at 65. It's 10 years later. It's 15 years later. They have a health plan that suits their needs. And they don't want to. They don't want Medicare, or they can't afford Medicare. Like Jim was describing, the hardship. New enrollees this year, it's $122 a month. New enrollees in Medicare next year will probably be in the 130s, quite possibly in the 140s. This is not an insignificant amount of money. So yes, for us, allowing folks to opt out, so you're not really changing the nature of the bill. It automatically enrolls them anyway. We believe, based on what we've heard from the NARF members, very few of them would do so, allowing the Postal Service to retain the bulk of that savings.
If I was 65 and I decided not to take Medicare Part B, say okay, fine, and then at 75, as you said, or even 70, you say, wait a minute, this is looking very good all of a sudden, but is it a 10% penalty for each year that you've missed
out? That's correct. Yeah, mm-hmm. It becomes, basically after 10 years, it doubles the cost of the premiums. And we often hear from members who say that at that level, they just can't afford the premiums. And what we encourage our members to do is think about their healthcare needs over the whole course of their retirement. And though a lot of people can be healthy at age 65 and not feel like they need this, you know, 100% coverage, but by the time they're 75, it's just the nature of aging. You get chronic conditions and your healthcare costs, your out-of-pocket costs really go through the roof, even if you have Medicare coverage. So we encourage that. We think for the vast majority of our members, they're going to be better off over the whole their whole lifetime, especially in just the peace of mind that comes with knowing that you're not going to be wiped out by medical bills, that this is why we encourage people to sign up to begin with. And by and large, it's affordable. When 85% of retired letter carriers sign up for Medicare Part B, that's an indication that for most people, it's an affordable cost and it makes sense for them. So I think our differences with NARF are just very minor. Yes. And I think we're really committed to working with them and all the other key parties to find a solution to this. And I think we will get there.
Well, you mentioned the fact of life that people usually don't get better as you get older. You know, regardless of what we say, you physically don't get better.
Mm-hmm. But I also add to what Jim said. It's not just your health moving forward, but also your life decisions. You know, a lot of people we hear from have an HMO, and that's the reason they don't want Medicare Part B. Mm-hmm. But if you move to a different state, that HMO may not be available.
Yeah.
So it's not just, you know, your future health. It's also some of the decisions you will make moving forward. I equate the decision to Medicare Part B very similar to the long-term care issue that we've been dealing with in the spike in the long-term care premiums for federal employees, because it's not just about the cost. It's, do you plan to move? Are you close to family? Who will take care of you if you get sick? And if you know, I look at my grandmother who solely relies on Medicare Part B, if you have to go into a nursing home or if you need in-home care, those costs can add up very, very quickly.
Jessica Clement is Legislative Director of the National Active and Retired Federal Employees Association. Jim Sauber is Chief of Staff of the National Association of Letter Carriers. After this break, more from the interview with Federal News Radio's Mike Causey. I'm Tom Temin.
USPS employees, during this busy holiday season, Sprint has a special offer just because of where you work. Save $5 every month for every line you have on their already amazing Unlimited Freedom plan. Four lines for $35 per month each. For a family of four lines, that's a savings of $20 per month. No more worrying about running out of data or surprise overage charges. Get unlimited data, talk, and text all while on the Sprint network. Restrictions apply. Learn more at a local Sprint store or visit sprint.com/USPS discounts.
A plan for separate health insurance just for postal employees and retirees has both boosters and doubters, such as the Heritage Foundation. For reaction, Federal News Radio's senior correspondent Mike Causey spoke with Jim Sauber, Chief of Staff for the National Association of Letter Carriers, and Jessica Clement, Legislative Director of the National Active and Retired Federal Employees Association.
Jesse, I know one of the problems you have with this is the fact that it actually comes out of the Heritage Foundation itself. Heritage is a good outfit, no doubt, good think tank in Washington, but they're admittedly very conservative, and they have been the source of most, if not all, of the data that newspapers and radio and TV have used to say that federal workers are overpaid, federal workers get paid more than people in the same jobs, federal workers, you know, but in every count, and you know, we all know what you can do with numbers, and it's not a matter of juggling them, it's the way you look at them, but they do have this, they come out with that government workers have got it made.
They do. I don't necessarily object to Walt's report coming from the Heritage Foundation, as the House proposal is really being championed by some of the more conservative members of the House caucus. But I think Jim and I can both agree that this is, while we object to certain provisions in this bill, one of the best postal bills we've seen that's actually gotten some traction in recent years. We both individually have our problems with it, but they've certainly come a long way. So the fact that it's Heritage doesn't necessarily alarm me, although based on some of the other reports, those certainly do. But more so the simplistic approach that Walt took to explaining the FEHBP in this report. If you take a look at it, it's very short. I was able to quickly read it on a plane ride not too long ago. Mm-hmm. He states frequently throughout it that the government pays 75% of enrollees FEHBP premiums. He doesn't actually go into details on what the formula is, and that being the government pays 72% of the average of all the FEHBP plans. So we're talking the average cost of all 250 plans. Government pays 72% of that, but a maximum of 75% of any one plan. So if you're in one of the cheaper plans, and that 72% average is, you know, 80% of that plan, the government's only going to pay 75. But I think by repeatedly saying in this report that the government pays 75%, Walt paints a very generous view of FEHBP for the people who are probably reading a report from the Heritage Foundation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jim?
Yeah, I mean, one of the problems he had is that you got to put this in context. This is always the nub when you have debates about comparability between public employees and private employees. You got to ask, compared to what? And the United States government's one of the largest employers in the country. And really, the proper comparison is other large national employers. And if you look at large national employers, you know, a 75% contribution to health premium is pretty standard. In fact, more than 50% of Fortune 1000 companies pay 75% or more. So you can't really compare the United States government and the millions of people it employs to the mom and pop shop down at the corner.
Yeah.
It's a different kind of labor market. And so it's important to get your comparisons right.
Well, that's one of the arguments when they say federal workers are overpaid, mm-hmm. and it's sort of the Henny Youngman thing, compared to what? Mm-hmm. You know, if Uncle Sam doesn't do retail, there's no box stores in the government, mm-hmm. there's no McDonald's or KFCs or whatnot. Mm-hmm. So when you compare the general population to the federal population, they will look fabulously rich, but that's not an accurate comparison.
I mean, everyone, I think, in this country right now is experiencing a grass is greener mentality. I think we have this zero-sum game that's occurring in our presidential election. You know, this person got something, which means I wasn't given something else. And people tend to look at things from their own perspective. So, you know, you look at, if you're one of the employees of the mom and pop shops, you may be looking at FEHBP as incredibly generous. If you're maybe at one of the larger government contractors or one of the larger employers, one of the Fortune 100, you look at certainly the benefits that the tech companies out in California, Netflix, Google, Apple, offer their employees. I don't think they're rushing to come work for the federal government.
Jessica Clement is legislative director of the National Active and Retired Federal Employees Association. Jim Sauber is chief of staff for the National Association of Letter Carriers, speaking with Federal News Radio's Mike Causey. Read more and find a link to the discussion at federalnewsradio.com. I'm Tom Temin.
Thank you for listening to Federal Insights, connecting U.S. Postal Service at its Future Needs Month. Sponsored by Sprint on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. The entire program can be heard on demand at federalnewsradio.com. Search USPS.